From Cherokee to Currituck, from the largest city to the smallest town, and from the state house to the schoolhouse, it's Carolina Journal Radio, your weekly news magazine discussing North Carolina's most important public policy events and issues.
Welcome to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. During the next hour, Donna Martinez and I will explore some major issues affecting our state. A teacher's race can play a role in determining a public school student's chance for success. You'll learn about recent research that applies that finding to charter schools. North Carolina lawmakers continue to haggle over a plan to cut the state's business franchise tax. You'll hear details. Republicans support the plan. Democrats oppose it. North Carolina has taken multiple steps in recent years to address the opioid crisis. A leading lawmaker recaps those steps. He also sets out ideas to pursue in the future. And we'll learn how a group called RIP Medical Debt is helping to remove a major burden for low-income patients in North Carolina. The John Locke Foundation's healthcare policy analyst describes his role. Those topics are just ahead. First, Donna Martinez joins us with the Carolina Journal headline.
On November 5th, Mecklenburg County voters gave a thumbs down to a proposed sales tax hike that was sold by supporters as a way to fund the arts and parks in that county. That actually makes twice in 5 years that Mecklenburg voters have said no to a higher sales tax. The county is one of many North Carolina counties that have attempted to convince voters over the years to raise sales taxes. Joe Coletti follows the sales tax hike effort in North Carolina. He's a senior fellow with the John Locke Foundation. He joins us now to talk about some really interesting data on this. Joe, welcome back to the show.
Glad to be here.
In Mecklenburg County, there was a whole lot of money
there was.
That was spent by supporters of the quarter cent hike in the sales tax to try to get this passed, but it didn't make it. Give us a sense of the factions. What was the argument like in Meck?
Sure. Yeah, there's as you mentioned, a lot of money spent, over $1 million spent in favor of the sales tax hike, and the opposition group, the main opposition group, had about $1,000. There was some others money spent, but yeah, those were the odds that were there. And with that $1 million, that was coming from the Carolina Panthers and from the Chamber of Commerce and from a number of other organizations. And the votes kind of broke down the same way, that it was the downtown, or in Charlotte, as it's called, uptown crowd, was in support of having this sales tax passed. And the suburbs and the poorer areas of Charlotte were against it. And that's what we saw with the votes, and that's kind of what we saw with who it was. Council members and commission members, Pat Cotham on the county commission, and Tariq Bakari. So you had a Democrat and a Republican both coming out against this. And part of it was about the regressive nature. Part of it was about what the money was being used for, that arts was the main selling point when it first came out, and that people didn't necessarily trust that the money would be used the way that the county commission said it was, on arts, on education, and on parks. And they even tried to bribe the northern cities in Mecklenburg County by saying that a portion of the money would go to Huntersville and the places up there. Didn't work.
Interesting that was the messaging wrong, or are North Carolina voters, in this case those in Mecklenburg County, really paying more attention perhaps to fiscal issues and what's going to directly impact their wallet?
That's where the question comes in, is that taxes that continue to lose more often than not, but people are still willing to support bonds. And so we saw across the state a number of bond issues pass. So it's not necessarily that people are looking for fiscal responsibility. It's that if they see that it's a tax hike and they see what it's being used for, especially in this case, there is some reticence to go along with that. In this case, especially because the sales tax is generally regressive, that it affects poor people with it takes a higher percentage of a poor person's income than it does a wealthy person's income. And then the money was going to go 22% of it, 45% of it, to the arts, which is mainly the ballet and groups like that are more patronized by people with higher incomes, that was where some of the discomfort came this time, in addition to the just general opposition to higher taxes, which explains where the Americans for Prosperity and some of the Republican opposition came from.
That's very interesting what you mentioned about the difference in perception, perhaps, between a sales tax hike and a bond referendum. Right. We saw during the election in early November in Durham, for example, they passed overwhelmingly an affordable housing bond. Mm-hmm. So it might be the issue itself if people think that something is, quote, worth it or not.
Yeah, and despite the language changes that the General Assembly has tried to impose on bond issues at the local level over time, they're still not necessarily so. There's partly the issue what the money's going to be used for, affordable housing versus the arts, and the perceptions that go along with those, but also partly the when a bond passes, people may go into it with an assumption that the city council or the county will be able to figure out how to use the money appropriately so that we may not have a tax increase in the future. We recognize that it has a tax impact, but it may not necessarily mean higher taxes directly. So,
and also that perception, I think, between sales tax, that means that's coming out of my purse right now, the next time I go to buy something, whereas that bond, it's kind of nebulous, so who pays for it and when. Down the road, I won't worry about that.
Yeah, there is a delay between the bond vote and when that eventually gets translated into property taxes, because there's about a year before the bonds actually get issued, and then another year before you start paying debt service on them. But even within Wake County, where there have been a number of bonds passed, including a $1 billion school bond a couple years ago, the translation of that into higher property taxes, we've seen higher property taxes in Wake County. Wake County now has higher taxes than property taxes than Mecklenburg, but it may not be that you connect the bond that we passed a couple years ago to the higher taxes today.
You know, Joe, it's interesting that Mecklenburg, with this sales tax hike going down, that's the second time in Mecklenburg that they've tried to pass that. And scads of other North Carolina counties have been putting this quarter-cent sales tax hike on the ballot over the past few years. You did some interesting analysis of that. Tell us what you found.
Well, taking a look at the sales tax votes since 2008, when we could take a look at what the turnout was for votes, found that generally, a 10% increase in turnout means a 2.5% decline in the percent of people voting for a tax increase. So the lower the turnout, and people, there's a general rule that people understand that the lower the turnout, the more likely you are to have higher taxes and to have more support for a tax increase. But it really came out in the numbers that you could see that it was 10% increase in turnout, 2.5% decrease in the percent of people voting for it. And you can kind of see that in this one, that in 2014, the last time that this was on the ballot in Mecklenburg, there was a 37% turnout, 61% of the people voted against. This time you lost about 4% of the people voting for it or voting against, while you had turnout fall by 20%. So but that's part of what this the General Assembly has done on that side as well, is we want to make sure that these votes happen when there is greater turnout, when every precinct is voting. So Mecklenburg is one of only two counties where you can have a vote on a bond during a municipal election. And we see that next year we have two votes in the primary and none indicated yet in the general election, but the higher the turnout, which you have in presidential elections and in primaries, in presidential primaries, the lower the likelihood of a passage.
And Joe, what you're really getting to here is if you are an elected official who is listening to Joe Coletti's analysis, you're thinking, aha, there is strategy to this as to when they might put these things on the ballot. So there's a lot of behind the scenes stuff that goes on. They don't just, you know, pull out of the air the date that something's going to be on a ballot.
No, primaries are more likely than in the general election. Municipals are more likely, but there are they have fewer options to start gaming with time than they used to.
Well, it's a fascinating analysis of what has gone on in North Carolina over the past 10 or 12 years, as more than 70 counties have gone to voters, my goodness, at least 160 times, asking to raise the local sales tax by a quarter cent. You can read Joe's analysis analysis of all of this at johnlock.org. Joe Coletti, thanks so much.
Thank you, Donna.
Stay with us. Much more Carolina Journal Radio to come in just a moment. Tired of fake news? Tired of reporters with political axes to grind? Well, you need to be reading Carolina Journal. Honest, uncompromising, old-school journalism you expect and you need. Even better, the monthly Carolina Journal is free to subscribers. Sign up at carolinajournal.com. You'll receive Carolina Journal newspaper in your mailbox each month. Investigations into government spending, revelations about boondoggles, who the powerful leaders are, and what they're doing in your name and with your money. We shine the light on it all with the stories and angles other outlets barely cover. But there's a bonus. Our print newspaper is published monthly. But our daily news site gives you the latest news each and every day. Log on to CarolinaJournal.com once, twice, even three times a day. You won't be disappointed. It's fresh news. And if you'd like a heads up on the daily news, sign up for our daily email. Do that at CarolinaJournal.com. Carolina Journal, rigorous, unrelenting, old school journalism. We hold government accountable for you.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. One of the most vexing problems in public education is an achievement gap between white and minority students. Our next guest has conducted research on ways to address this problem. Dr. Seth Gershenson is professor of public policy at American University. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me. Happy to be here.
Let's get into one of your key findings that actually predates your most recent study, and that is that when it comes to this achievement gap and addressing it, the teacher's race makes a big difference. How so?
Yeah, that's right. So a study that we published 2 years ago has gotten a lot of attention, and it builds on previous work that shows that when students have a same race teacher, they have better test scores. And we built on that work to look at long-run outcomes that we really care about. You know, the test score gap is really only interesting to the extent that test scores predict long-run outcomes like earnings, college graduation, and so on. So we look to see whether these race match effects really do carry out to long-run outcomes. And we do so using two different data sources. One is a actual experiment where students and teachers were randomly assigned to classrooms in Tennessee. The other is in North Carolina. And in both data sets, we find very compelling evidence that, yes, when you have at least one black teacher in elementary school, black students are significantly more likely to complete high school and to enroll in college. So that just shows that those same race teacher effects on test scores are not one-off flukes or anything like that, but they really do affect students' long-run outcomes.
This leads then into a new study that you've done in connection with the Fordham Institute.
Right.
And this involves this effect of the same race teacher effect and charter schools. Tell us about that.
Right. So the Fordham Institute was interested in whether these race match effects that are traditionally documented in traditional public schools also show up in charter schools. So once again, we got data from North Carolina. North Carolina Education Research Data Center is a group at Duke in North Carolina, University of North Carolina, that make very rich administrative data available to researchers. And this really gave us an opportunity to dig in and see what's happening in charter schools. And the short answer is yes, these race match effects do exist in charter schools, and they're actually bigger. So the effect on test scores is about twice as large as it is in traditional public schools.
Do you have a sense from the research as to why?
Generally, we don't know exactly why, but there's likely a few different reasons. One reason in particular has to do with expectations, we think. There's a similar same race effect on teacher expectations. They're much more likely to expect that a student will complete college. And in other work that I've done with colleagues at Johns Hopkins, we show that teacher expectations matter for college completion and long-run outcomes as well. So one factor is certainly this idea of high expectations. Another related idea is a role model effect where, especially for more disadvantaged students, seeing a teacher who looks like them from a neighborhood like theirs, it sends a signal that, you know, rising to a professional career in the middle class is possible. And then the third story is that there's probably better communication. And there's different names for this type of communication. Some people may call it culturally relevant pedagogy. or teaching a hidden curriculum. But these ideas are all interrelated in the sense that when you have a teacher who looks like you, you get more out of the relationship and build a deeper, more trusting relationship.
That is the voice of Professor Seth Gershenson of American University talking about this new interesting study done in connection with the Fordham Institute involving teacher race and charter schools. So you have some interesting findings. What do you hope will come out of this? I know that there are some ideas of where to go forward now.
Mm-hmm. That's an important question. So the first obvious response is, well, then let's hire a more diverse teaching force. The student population in the United States is about 50% white right now, and the teaching force is 80 to 85% white. So there's an imbalance there. So a lot of people will read our research and others' research on the topic and say, well, we have to diversify the teaching force. And while that's certainly an important and laudable goal, that's not feasible in the short run. The reason is that the supply of non-white teachers just isn't there right now. So there's a pipeline problem or supply problem. So a long-run goal is to absolutely get more non-white, Black, and Hispanic teachers students into college and interested in teaching career. But that's very much a longer-term goal. So for policymakers and school leaders right now, what can we do today? There's a few things. One is to make more creative use of the diversity that we do have in our classrooms. So one simple idea is that if there's a handful of Black teachers in a school, say, we could rearrange the school day so that all students interact with all teachers over the course of a year. Maybe that's through having different special topics or mixing classes or things like that. Another idea is that these role model effects don't necessarily have to come from teachers. We can also bring professionals from the community into schools to give little, career fair type presentations or other just discussions about what they do and how they were successful in school and so on. So, for example, there's a really neat experiment where a high school in France had – this isn't exactly the same context as here, but – this high school in France had female scientists come to ninth grade science classrooms and give short 15-minute presentations about what they do in a given day at their work. And this had a big effect on female high school students' later enrollment in college and science and STEM programs. So that wasn't teachers. That was just bringing in professionals and sort of benefiting and piggybacking on this role model effect. So we could absolutely do things like that in public schools here. And lastly, we can do much better at training all of our teachers of all backgrounds to better empathize and work with students of all backgrounds.
And I gather from the research, another important thing was making sure that these teachers have high expectations for all students.
Yeah, exactly. And so that's what I meant by some of these training programs and professional development programs. There's a lot of compelling work right now that even a relatively short one-hour training program can move the needle on teachers' empathy levels, expectation levels, and attitudes towards students of different backgrounds for teachers of all types. So there are professional development opportunities out there that all teachers of all backgrounds would benefit from.
One thing I wanted to clarify before we wrap up is this notion of the impact of the teacher's race. This doesn't mean that a student has to have the teacher of the same race to succeed, just at least some access to having someone of the same race at some point, whether it is the teacher or someone from the outside.
Right. So a few points about that. The first, one of the more nuanced results in our work is that for a lot of this benefit comes from just having one Black teacher. So in other words, the extra benefit of a second Black teacher is relatively small once you've had that first exposure. Similarly, in the Fordham study, we show that the effects are muted in schools with Black principals, which is really interesting. So again, it suggests that sort of any sort of exposure sort of delivers this role model benefit or this race match effect. And again, we can use that information to better and more strategically allocate our teachers that we have.
Well, it's very interesting research, and we thank Dr. Seth Gershenson, professor of public policy at American University, for sharing that knowledge with us. Thanks.
Great. Thank you.
And we'll have more on Carolina Journal Radio in just a moment.
If you love freedom, we've got great news to share with you. Now you can find the latest news, views, and research from conservative groups across North Carolina all in one place, NorthCarolinaConservative.com. It's one-stop shopping for North Carolina's freedom movement. At NorthCarolinaConservative.com, you'll find links to John Locke Foundation blogs on the day's news, CarolinaJournal.com reporting and quick takes, Carolina Journal radio interviews, TV interviews featuring CJ reporters and Locke Foundation analysts, opinion pieces and reports on higher education from the James G. Martin Center for Academic Renewal, commentary and polling data from the Civitas Institute, and news and views from the North Carolina Family Policy Council. That's right, all in one place, NorthCarolinaConservative.com. That's North Carolina spelled out, conservative.com. NorthCarolinaConservative.com. Try it today.
North Carolina is changing, not just day to day, but hour to hour, minute to minute, even second to second. How can you keep up with the changes, especially the ones that affect you, your family, your home, your job? Make the John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal part of your social media diet. On Facebook, like the John Locke Foundation, like Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal. News, insights, and analysis you'll find nowhere else. Thanks to the experts at the John Locke Foundation, and thanks to the first-class investigative reporting of Carolina Journal. Don't wait for the morning newspaper. Don't wait for the evening news. If it's happening now, it's happening here. The John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal have you covered with up-to-the-second information. Like us on Facebook, the John Locke Foundation, and Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal.
Who knew you could shop and invest in freedom at the same time? It is true. Online shopping is now a great way to support the John Locke Foundation. Just shop using the Amazon Smile program and designate the John Locke Foundation to receive a portion of your purchase amount. That's right. You shop. Amazon donates money to us, the John Locke Foundation. Here's how. Log on to smile.amazon.com. Amazon Smile is the same Amazon you know. Same products, same prices. But here's what's better. Amazon donates 0.5% of the price of your eligible Amazon Smile purchases to the John Locke Foundation. So try it. Be sure to designate us as the nonprofit you want to support. It's that easy. So now, not only will you enjoy what you buy, you'll also support freedom. Don't forget, log on to smile.amazon.com today. Buy something nice and help defend freedom. Help support the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. North Carolina legislators continue to debate the future of the state business franchise tax. Republicans want to cut the tax, eventually eliminating it. But the first proposed cut drew an objection from Democratic Senator Floyd McKissick. He's concerned about lost revenue.
There's no guarantee there's going to be additional revenue coming to the state. And if we look at the projected financial losses here, by the time we get to 2023-24, we're talking about $314 million. And if you look at the cumulative losses in that period, by that point in time, you would have exceeded $1 billion. So we're basically, by implementing this legislation, agreeing that just in the next 3 to 4 years is $1 billion of revenue that we are writing off the charts and our books. And that does give me concern, because I know there's substantial expenses and needs in the state that need to be addressed. And I'm not hearing a burning concern from these businesses to say, we got to get this reduced. If so, those businesses that pay franchise taxes wouldn't be here in North Carolina today.
Republican Senator Paul Newton responded to McKissick's complaint. He focused on the role of taxes in North Carolina's economic growth.
You don't improve your status by standing still. If we become complacent and don't find ways to attract additional employment, additional capital investment, then we will be left behind. I guarantee you, not only the states surrounding us, but across the United States and in other parts of the world, they want every employer that we are getting in North Carolina. So we cannot stand still. We're also judged to have the number one economy in North Carolina this year by CNBC. That doesn't happen by standing still. So I thought it would be interesting to know, you know, of course, we lost out on Amazon's second headquarters, and they would have, if they had located in North Carolina, that would have been, based on their own projections of capital investment, $3.75 million a year that they would have paid for the privilege of being in North Carolina, whether they made a dime or not.
Newton placed the franchise tax proposal in a larger context.
We owe it to the next generation of North Carolinians to do things differently, smarter, to make sure we're creating good jobs for their kids and their grandkids. And the only way to do that is to attract capital investment and attract jobs to North Carolina. The franchise tax, make no mistake about it, even if you do like it or don't like it, it penalizes capital investment. It penalizes it. The more you invest today, the more you invest in North Carolina, the more you're going to be paying for that investment, whereas other states, that is not the case.
That's Republican State Senator Paul Newton. He's defending legislative Republicans' plan to reduce, with the hope of eventually eliminating, North Carolina's state business franchise tax. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
We're doubling down on freedom. At Carolina Journal Radio, we're proud to bring you stories that impact your life and your wallet. And now, get twice as much freedom when you also listen to our podcast, Headlock, available on iTunes and at johnlock.org/podcast. Now, Headlock is a little bit different. It's a no-holds-barred discussion that challenges soft-headed ideas from the left and the right. But like Carolina Journal Radio, Headlock is smart and timely. But with Headlock, you'll hear more about the culture wars, and you'll get some more humor as well. We guarantee great information and a good time. Double down with us. Listen to Carolina Journal Radio each week, and listen to Headlock, too. Remember, you can listen to Headlock at johnlock.org/podcast, or subscribe or download each week at iTunes. Carolina Journal Radio and Headlock, just what you need to stay informed and stay entertained. Both brought to you in the name of freedom by the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. North Carolina's General Assembly has taken several steps in recent years to fight the state's problem with opioid drugs. Republican State Senator Jim Davis discussed those efforts during an event at Western Carolina University, sponsored by the Center for the Study of Free Enterprise. Davis recalled how a conversation with a friend in law enforcement directed his attention to the issue.
He said, "I'm tired of putting young people in body bags. We've got to do something about this issue." And so there, from that moment, I became a champion dealing with this issue. I'm an unlikely candidate or combatant in this war against opiates and other drugs because I spent most of my life ignorant of the magnitude of the issue. I was an individual who, before Nancy Reagan made it popular, I was a just say no individual. That worked for me, being scared straight.
Davis says his attitude about opioid abuse has changed over the years.
Over time in dealing with this issue, I've transitioned from what's wrong with you to what happened to you. And that's made a huge difference in how I've approached this opioid issue and all addiction issue, whether it's tobacco, alcohol, drugs, sex, work, whatever your addiction is, it usually is impacted by something that's happened to you. And also in this journey, I've learned about ACEs, adverse childhood experiences. And I'm convinced that we're never going to be able to treat our way out of this problem. We're never going to be able to incarcerate our way out of this problem. We need to address the underlying issues, the adverse childhood experiences, the PTSD, and all those things that precipitate this addictive behavior.
Davis recounted for his Western Carolina University audience the laws approved in Raleigh to deal with opioids. The first substantial measure was named the STOP Act.
The STOP Act is intended to reduce the supply of unused, misused, and diverted opioids circulating in North Carolina. It also is intended to reduce doctor shopping and improve care by requiring prescribers to use tools and resources that help prevent inappropriate prescribing. Another thing that came out of the STOP Act was a directive from that legislation to begin a task force for opioid sentencing reform. Again, like I said, law enforcement tells us they cannot arrest their way out of this problem. So we were looking at ways that we could take low-level offenders, those offenders who had like a month's supply of drug, which would put them over the limit to put them in the classification of being dealers, but they had all these drugs for their personal use. And so we wanted a way in order to divert those individuals who didn't have a violent history into treatment rather than incarceration. Unfortunately, when you're incarcerated, you only have a 1 in 6 chance of getting significant drug treatment in our prison system. And so it's all the more important that we can divert these individuals. Again, they're nonviolent. To drug treatment courts and to treatment rather than incarcerating them.
After the STOP Act, state lawmakers approved another piece of legislation with an easy acronym. It was called the HOPE Act.
The STOP Act focused on prescriptions going from doctor to patient or prescriber to patient, and the HOPE Act is about stemming the flow of lawful pharmaceuticals into the illegal drug sales and illegal use. I've learned a lot in this journey and found out that some people, that pet owners, they abuse their pets, even break their dog's legs in order to take them to the veterinarian to get opioids for their pet, and then they take them. I've learned about individuals, nurses and nurse practitioners that in the hospitals that are diverting opioids to their own personal use or selling it. I've learned about individuals that have diluted the medication and substituted it with other things.
That's State Senator Jim Davis, one of the legislative leaders on bills dealing with opioids. He mentioned a third piece of legislation after the STOP Act and HOPE Act. It was the Opioid Epidemic Response Act. It had several interesting pieces, including
decriminalize the use of testing strips. And again, that was a hard sell for somebody who doesn't want to enable bad behavior. But a lot of the overdoses have to do, like you've learned, with fentanyl, which is fentanyl is 50 to 100 times more potent than morphine. And that's the drug that's really coming in. A lot of people that are going to treatment programs, they come out, they go to their old dealer, and they take some drugs again, and if it's laced from fentanyl, that's 50 to 100 times more potent than morphine, then that's a lot of overdoses. So we decriminalized the use of testing strips. Before that, testing strips were used by drug dealers, and we removed that ban.
Davis also highlighted the death by distribution law, which aims to punish drug dealers who contribute to their customers' deaths.
It was met with a lot of worries about unintentional consequences. But we implemented in that legislation, we were very careful not to dilute the Good Samaritan law that we had passed earlier. And so it's not perfect. There's no such thing as perfect legislation in the legislature.
Davis says the work is not over. What does the General Assembly still need to do?
We need to regulate pain clinics more. A lot of pain clinics, they used to be really rampant off I-75 in Florida. They've gotten a handle on them, and we need to regulate those in North Carolina. One of the problems that we're dealing with controlled substance reporting system and with regulating all these things is we're so close to other states, and people can just go over across the state line and have access to drugs and prescriptions in other places.
There's another long-term goal.
I've tried to get benzodiazepines as part of the controlled substance reporting system. Xanax and Valium are two common benzos. And our overdose people will tell you that about 40-some percent of the overdose victims have benzos in their system. But that is another thing that we have to live to fight another day.
Davis wants a centralized agency targeting treatment.
We need to establish a state opioid treatment authority with a registration fee. There are a lot of bad actors in the treatment world out there, and there's a lot of money to be made if you're a bad actor There's money to be made if you're a good actor, but not so much. And we have some incredibly good programs in North Carolina and in this country, but they're expensive. But there are some bad actors, and so I attempted to put in legislation that would require treatment facilities to join a nationally recognized authority so that we knew that when people go there for treatment, they're getting good treatment, not just wasting money.
North Carolina also could see a piece of national lawsuit settlement money.
We're looking at getting billions of dollars from these pharmaceutical companies that push these opioids. And like somebody, like the nurse said, there's a good use for opioids in the medical field. My wife just had back surgery 3 weeks ago today, and she had fentanyl post-operatively, and she had some other opioids, and she didn't take them all. Unfortunately for that, she didn't need them. But what she said was, if you take a Tylenol and a Motrin together, they're very effective. Some studies show that they're just as effective as opiates. But we need to ensure that the money that we get from these pharmaceutical companies comes to a central clearinghouse in the state, and that clearinghouse ensures that that money doesn't get diverted to another budget item in the state budget. It goes to treatment to help those individuals and families impacted by the opioid crisis.
Davis plans to leave the General Assembly after 10 years of service. He knows the fight against opioid abuse will continue.
This Prescription Drug Abuse Advisory Committee will outlast me, but there are other champions in the legislature to continue our fight against this modern-day plague on our society.
That's State Senator Jim Davis speaking recently at Western Carolina University. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
Real influence. You either have it or you don't. And at the John Locke Foundation, we have it. You'll find our guiding principles in many of the Freedom Forward reforms of the past decade here in North Carolina. So while others talk or complain or name call, we provide research, solutions, and hope. Our team analyzes the pressing issues of the day, jobs, healthcare, education, and more. We look for effective ways to give you more freedom, more options, more control over your life. Our goal is to transform North Carolina into a growing, thriving economic powerhouse, the envy of every other state. Our research has helped policymakers make decisions that ensure you keep more of what you earn, expand your choice of schools for your kids, widen your job opportunities, improve your access to doctors. The recipe for stability and a bright future. For truth, for freedom, for the future of North Carolina. We are the John Locke Foundation. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Donna Martinez. Over the past decade, we've had a big debate in this country over how to expand access to affordable health insurance and affordable health care. But despite passage of the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, affordability of insurance and care remains elusive to some, particularly those who have high deductibles and high copays with their insurance policies. That can lead to medical bills that some folks simply cannot pay. Our next guest is working with a private effort to help wipe away old medical debt that's dogging some low-income North Carolinians. Jordan Roberts is the healthcare policy analyst for the John Locke Foundation. He joins us now to talk about this. Jordan, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
I thought Obamacare was going to make insurance and care affordable.
Yeah.
It hasn't.
That's right. So, you know, we hear all the times about people struggling to afford insurance. And then a lot of times, even when they have insurance, it doesn't work for them in that, you know, you pay a premium and you expect some of your all of your medical care to be covered, but then you go to the hospital, go to the emergency room, and you wind up with a huge surprise bill or a balance bill from, you know, a doctor that wasn't in network, and then the insurance company says you're on the hook for that. So, you know, while we have trouble with affordability, we also have trouble with insurance not working the way it's supposed to for folks.
Tell us about a balance bill and a surprise bill. You mentioned both of those. What are they?
So this is some of the most pervasive of issues with insurance is that when you go to the hospital and get a procedure done, your insurance company and the hospital negotiate to pay what you know they think is a fair rate. And sometimes if it's the hospital charges more than what the insurer is willing to pay, the a hospital will balance bill a patient and send them the remainder of the bill. So that's one example. If there's just a disagreement between an insurer and a provider, and the patient really has no say in that. And then the other example is a surprise bill is when, let's say, you go and get a procedure done and the hospital's in network, your surgeon's in network, but then the anesthesiologist is out of network. And so you think you're all covered, you've paid your co-insurance and your deductible, then all of a sudden you get a surprise bill from an anesthesiologist who's not in network, and that could be double, triple what the procedure costs you in the first place. And once again, being out of network, your insurance is not going to cover that. So this happens all the time, many different examples and different ways that it can happen. But, you know, the main point is that the patient really has no recourse or any way to, you know, negotiate this bill or anything. And oftentimes they're stuck paying it.
So no matter how or why it comes, you're going to get a statement in the mail that says that you owe, and it could be thousands of dollars.
Absolutely.
Now, as you said, you can't challenge this. You just have to look at it and say, okay, how do I pay this? And
right.
The reality is that some people, particularly those who are of modest income levels, living paycheck to paycheck, simply cannot pay the bills. So the bill ends up going to collection?
Right. So that's what happens. Sometimes these hospitals will, you know, try to go and collect these wages or collect these bills in different number of ways. We heard there's a big story out of South Carolina that they were using the local revenue departments to garnish tax returns to get these bills back. Sometimes they even just sue patients and take them to court. So, yeah, there's a lot of different ways that they can go about it. But, you know, once again, the patient's just really either doesn't know or has no means to pay that when they weren't suspected the bill in the first place.
So this then becomes an issue for their credit report as they try to go ahead and pay their other bills,
right,
knowing that this big bill is looming. It's gone to collection. The hospital is trying to get the money. Then the hospital can also sell off that debt to,
right,
private collection firms.
Yeah. And so that happens too. And then, you know, it's off the hospital's books, which is their eventual goal to get paid anything. So they'll take whatever. And now the debt is over to a collection agency, which has become a pretty big industry now because of so many outstanding medical bills with our convoluted healthcare system. So this is a pretty persistent, you know, industry here that will buy debt and then own the debt, and then they use different means to try to collect it too, just like the hospital.
This is where it gets really interesting. And Jordan, you are involved in a project, and this is a private project.
Mm-hmm.
It's outside of the John Locke Foundation,
right,
where you are a policy analyst, but you've gotten involved in an effort to try to actually help these people who are now being dogged by this old medical debt. It's hurting their credit report, and it's something just looming in their lives. Tell us about RIP Medical Debt.
Yeah, so I'm really excited for a service project I'm doing. I'm partnering with RIP Medical Debt to wipe out as much medical, old medical debt as we can for individuals in North and South Carolina. And so the individuals for the debt, in order to qualify for the program, the debt has to be, or the individual has to be making less than 2 times the federal poverty line. They have to owe more than 5% of their annual income, and the debts have to be greater than their total assets. So these are, we're talking about the lowest income individuals that really have no means to pay these off. And the great thing about RIP medical debt is it was started by two old collection agency executives. And so what they now do is they sponsor campaigns like mine to raise money. I will give them the money, and they will purchase portfolios of old debt off the secondary debt market, where like we were talking about before, that these collection agencies have bought, and they will wipe it completely clean and no effect on their credit. So it's really great. And the best part about partnering with RIP Medical Debt is the collection agency expertise allows them to purchase the debt for pennies on the dollar. So roughly it comes out to every dollar that I can raise will wipe out about $100 of old medical debt.
Jordan, this is really amazing because you're talking about something here where government's not involved. This
mm-hmm.
is a private effort. It's you as an individual reaching out to literally impact and change the lives of unknown numbers of North Carolinians
mm-hmm.
and South Carolinians as well,
right,
involved in your effort. That's amazing.
Yeah, I'm really excited about it. And, I hope what we can do here is raise as much money as possible, raise the awareness of this issue that a lot of times these people come to this debt through no fault of their own. And this is not to say that, you shouldn't pay your bills and should collect up debt you should rack up debt that other people are going to pay off. This is, really people that fall victim to the problems of our healthcare system through no fault of their own, just trying to access care. And then all of a sudden their hands strung by some multi-thousand-dollar bill that lingers forever. So those are the people we're trying to help out that become victim and really have no other means to get out of the red.
Jordan, I have to applaud you because this really does fit into the mission of free enterprise and personal responsibility, individuals reaching out to help other people. And again, no government involved. Right. And this is really what it's all about.
Yeah, thank you.
Now, if people are interested in finding out more about Jordan's effort and RIP medical debt, just send an email over to Jordan. Jordan, you want to give out your email address?
Yeah. So my email is jroberts@johnlock.org. And I also have a link for the fundraiser page. If you go to bit.ly/JordanRoberts, my name, you will find my RIP medical debt fundraising page. You can donate money there too. Also there's a link to buy tickets to an event, a fundraising event that I'm holding in February. All ticket proceeds will go towards the fundraiser. So we hope that everyone can join us for a night of food and drinks, raising awareness about this issue that's plaguing our neighbors.
And Jordan, again, Jordan is a healthcare policy analyst here at the John Locke Foundation. Thank you very much, Jordan.
Thanks, Donna.
That's all the time we have for the program this week. Thank you for listening. On behalf of my co-host, Mitch Kokai, I'm Donna Martinez. Hope you'll join us again next week for more Carolina Journal Radio.
Carolina Journal Radio is a program of the John Locke Foundation. To learn more about the John Locke Foundation, including donations that support programs like Carolina Journal Radio, send email to development@johnlock.org or call 1-866-JLF-INFO. That's 1-866-553-4636.
Carolina Journal Radio is a co-production of the John Locke Foundation, North Carolina's free market think tank, and Carolina Broadcasting System, Incorporated. All opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of advertisers or the station. For more information about the show or other programs and services of the John Locke Foundation, visit johnlock.org or call us toll-free at 866-JLF-INFO. We'd like to thank our wonderful radio affiliates across North Carolina and our sponsors. From all of us at Carolina Journal Radio, thank you for listening, and please join us again next week.